I know parents aren't supposed to have favorite kids, but as a podcaster, you can have a favorite episode, right? Because I do. So far, it's been our conversation with Sam Korkos, co-founder of Levels, a cutting-edge startup in the health tech space. Sam is extremely precise. He's the kind of person who operates with so much intention and who gets so much out of the day. It's hard to imagine him on vacation, which is where we at Funded are currently, taking a mini break. Hence the rerun. But trust me, it's an oldie but a goodie.
I've had the quarterly goal of staying in touch with 1,000 people that I care about. And it takes a lot of time, probably 30 hours a week. But it's also the single most valuable thing that I do.
This is Funded, a show where founders who raised millions in venture capital share the gritty side of what it actually took to get that money in the bank. I'm Jason Yeh, your host. Not too long ago, I was trying to get my ideas funded. And back in the day, I was a VC listening to founders pitch me for money. How often do you talk to your colleagues from your very first job? When was the last time you emailed your favorite professor from college? Or that person who did you a small favor 5 years ago? For me, and I think most people, the answer is those check-ins have been sitting on my to-do list for ages. But that isn't the case for Sam Korkos, because what you'll discover very soon is that Sam isn't most people. As you heard, he keeps in touch with thousands of connections. In fact, that's the reason he points to for how they were able to quickly launch Levels, an innovative health tech company with a cutting-edge bio-wearable device to track metabolic health. Part one of our two-part series with Sam is all about the power of relationships and networking, because the way he talks about this fairly well-covered topic is unique and special. Like with most other things in his life, for him, it's not an art, it's a science. And one that he approaches like everything he does. He gives it everything he's got.
I'm probably pathologically competitive. It's like, it is maybe the single greatest motivator for things that I do. I also play a lot of board games. That's like new, unique, and interesting strategy games are something that I really enjoy learning how to do. I really like playing board games against people who are better than me, because I always tend to learn something from them. It's a really fun thing.
And it's so tempting to start jumping to the future of the board game that you played against venture capitalists, but I don't want to do that. I'd rather ask, you know, if you put yourself in kind of the seat of 13-year-old Sam, would you have imagined the career for yourself and where you got to today?
Not at all. When I was that age, the thing that was most interesting to me was science. I actually worked in an oncology lab for 2 summers while I was in high school and published a paper on non-small cell lung carcinoma with a med student. And my goal was very much to go the route of like basic research and science. And that was what I was most interested in. I got pretty frustrated with academic science early on through some personal experiences through those 2 summers. And I'm fortunate that I did, because I think I have a lot of friends who ended up going that path. And it's a little bit late after you get your PhD to decide that you want to do something completely different. So yeah, I would definitely say it would have been a huge surprise. This is not the path that I expected I would be on, but I'm glad that I did.
I've been able to do some research around your path. It looks like after that stint in research where you dodged a bullet, you jumped on to the entrepreneurial train. And when I look at your background, it does look like elite preparation for a startup. You know, you're the CTO of a couple startups. You went through the two prestigious programs, Y Combinator, as well as like the very buzzy OnDeck Fellowship program. Mm-hmm. So a lot of stuff went into getting to where you are today. As you look back on all those experiences, what do you see from each of those things that kind of drove you to one, starting levels, and then two,
yeah,
set you up for what you know and what you executed just a few months ago?
I think the biggest ones were more like emotional hurdles to overcome. You know, when my first company, which I started largely just after college, when my first company effectively failed, it was in construction software, and we were doing, I think, $60,000 to $80,000 a year in revenue after a year of effort, and it was pretty clear. We bootstrapped it, so we didn't raise any capital for it, but it was pretty clear it was not going to grow in the way that we wanted it to. And in the back of my mind was this lingering fear that everyone would perceive me as a failure and like my life would be worse. And it just wasn't the case. When you give it your best effort and you stay a high integrity person and you don't cheat people and you're making an honest effort to do your best, people actually really respect it. There's a quote which I think has a lot more to do with like vulnerability in conversation generally, but I found it really resonated was, what we see as courage in others, we see as weakness in ourselves. And so when you see like, man, that was such a brave thing for that person to do, but like if I did that, everyone would see me as weak. And it really just being able to see yourself from like a third party perspective and having been through it and being on the other side of it, realizing like everyone was very positive as opposed to very negative. And it mm-hmm. really, it was mostly the emotional hurdles to overcome that were, I think, the most influential.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I think you describe some elements of imposter syndrome, things that I see mm-hmm. in a lot of super elite founders, executives, et cetera. Actually thinking about myself here, it took way longer deep into my 30s to get that realization that it sounds like kind of your early startup experience really drove you towards. Very, very cool to hear. Yeah, you know, the thing that I want to transition to is a little bit about OnDeck and why you decided to go into OnDeck and how it led you to this company in particular.
Yeah, OnDeck, primarily I got involved because it was just intellectually interesting to me.
Hmm. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about what is it that gets society to the next level? And there's actually a great book by Andrew Yang, Smart People Should Build Things, that I wish I had read it in college. It would have really helped a lot. But I remember reading it, and there were moments in this book where he talks about the social pressure to go into finance or law. And I'm just like, I lived this. This book is describing my lived experience and how hard it is to overcome those emotional barriers of like leaving a comfortable job and being judged by your parents and like being taking those risks. It's a really hard thing to do. And the thing that I liked intellectually about OnDeck is that it is a program that the goal is to increase top of funnel of people starting companies. And they find really capable people who probably otherwise may or may not start their own company. They might also just be perfectly happy being an engineer at Google. But if you provide them an ecosystem of support where they can see other people who have done it and they think like, wow, this is actually achievable. If you can increase the number of people who are willing to take those risks, I think the world will be better. So that was really my main motivation for getting involved, was just to understand how this works. Wow. I'm a huge fan of what they're doing. If they can really scale that up, I think it will have a meaningfully positive impact on the world. I took a year off work after Kardash, and I spent the better part of that year thinking through how I wanted to spend my time. And one of the things that I found was I really wanted to work on something that was meaningful. And I think at peak, I was experimenting with something like 16 different projects, each of which were like plausible company ideas. And I would put a little bit of time into them. I'd do some market exploration, and I would see, like, does this really have potential? Mm-hmm. And I would call my friend Eric. Eric's now at Founders Fund, but he's a friend from college. And I would call him somewhat regularly and pitch him on my ideas, and he would always shoot them down. And he would apologize for it, saying, like, I'm really sorry that, like, I keep saying no to all your ideas. And I kept telling him, like, every time you say no to an idea saves me like 5 years of my life. So like I should be thanking you more than anything. And it's just helpful to socialize these things and to learn from it. And what I did end up getting from OnDeck specifically, I met my co-founder, Andrew. We have 5 co-founders at Levels. Andrew is one of them, and he's incredibly capable, and he manages all engineering at the company. I've been on the technical side for basically my entire career, so I thought it would be a lot harder for me to let go of it, but Andrew is so capable that anytime I look into it, like on what engineering is up to, they're always way further ahead than I thought we were.
You're like, wow, this guy is way better than I was, which is what you want in a co-founder, right?
Exactly.
So what about the very specific topic around high-level health and optimization of health? You know, what sort of drove that for you? And is that a passion of yours, or is it more something you took off the shelf?
I would say that less of a personal motivation of like my own health and a lot more to do with solving global scale problems. The thing that really flipped the switch for me taking Levels more seriously was when I started using a continuous glucose monitor really just as a novelty. And I didn't expect that it would be interesting. And within a couple days, I started discovering things that I thought were super healthy for my entire life, like orange juice and oatmeal. And I was seeing numbers that healthy people are not supposed to be able to see. And it was when I started digging into the scope of the problem that I started to realize, like, this is a leverage point to start to tackle metabolic dysfunction. I wrote a little bit about this in the Secret Master Plan that we published on our blog, but the fact that more than 10% of the United States is already diabetic, and it's increasing at an increasing rate. The second derivative is positive. When I realized how serious this problem is, and that it was basically this recognition that this company needs to exist and does not exist yet, and I'm in a position to make it exist. So I felt some responsibility to do that. It's really the motivator.
Would love to transition to what we love talking about here at Funded and a little bit more about fundraising. You know, I want to ask you what your experience level with fundraising was before. I noticed that you have been a founder, co-founder in the past, but you may or may not have been sort of the point person on fundraising.
Yeah, I've always been on the technical side. So this is definitely my first time leading a fundraising effort or being involved in any meaningful capacity. Okay. I have in the past been in the room during pitch meetings, mostly to answer technical questions if people had them. So we bootstrapped my first company. We largely bootstrapped the second one. And then at Kardash, we raised from Index and Felices and a few others. But my involvement in that process was really sitting in and answering questions much more than it was being active in the process.
After the break, Sam goes from watching from the sidelines to being in the action, calling the plays. I spend most of my days one-on-one with founders, helping them understand strategies that make a difference in fundraising. One super important tip I always stress with founders is to make sure they send their decks and materials using a document sharing tool. And for that, I always recommend DocSend. DocSend lets you know what's happening with your deck after you send it along, with real-time analytics and notifications. Did the VCs actually open it? What slides did they spend the most time on? And if you think it got shared with the wrong people, or maybe you made a mistake and sent it too quickly, DocSend lets you control access and make updates to content even after sending. Sign up for a free 2-week trial at docsend.com/funded. That's docsend.com/funded. When you're fundraising for the first time, it can feel a lot like you're winging it. Because while on the surface, asking investors for money seems pretty straightforward, once you start digging in, you'll find a convoluted mess of hard-to-access networks, frustrating power dynamics, and make-your-head-spin processes. On top of that, no matter how much you Google or endlessly scroll on Twitter, you'll be hard-pressed to find a definitive guide. What you find online from one expert will oftentimes completely contradict another so-called expert. But Sam, well, he took a different path, and the results were nothing short of amazing. What you're about to hear is not unlike a mad scientist testing ingredients to come up with the perfect potion for fundraising. It blew me away because these are things I had never thought of before, and I think about this space a lot.
I wouldn't jump to this conclusion with all founders, but given your scientific background and everything you've told me, it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there probably was a preparation process. So, you know, how did you decide what you were going to do? Did you have mentors, people that you whose brains you picked, books? I'd love to kind of hear your process around that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was basically just thinking about the fundraising process from first principles and understanding how it works and how information is distributed through venture networks. During my year off, I actually spent probably a good 3 months deeply studying network and graph theory just to better understand how networks work. And one of my biggest conclusions was that in my next company, I wanted to build an early cap table of really well-connected angels and founders, specifically people with high eigenvector centrality, who can give me access to other disparate networks that I otherwise would not be able to reach.
Is that the definition of eigenvector centrality? Or can you give us a couple more words?
Yeah, you can think of it as like second order centrality. There are many different types of network centrality. One is just degree centrality, which is like, it's the more technical term of what people would just call popularity. How popular is this person? How many people do they know? But you can be, you can have high degree centrality. If you're like the mayor of a small town and you know everyone in the town, you have high degree centrality, but you probably have low eigenvector centrality because you only know people within one dense network. So eigenvector centrality is how many people do the people that you know? So yeah, it's like one degree beyond that. So people who are very well connected among other people who are well connected are the kinds of people that you want to get involved early because networks are incredibly hard to predict and they're very complex. So if you get somebody who is very well connected and can think in a networked way, you can start to get access to things that you would be shocked that you have access to.
Sure.
Like, I want to talk to this basketball player. And you just ask a group of people that you know have high eigenvector centrality. They're like, well, I don't know him personally, but my friend Mark grew up with him. It's like, what? How did that happen?
You would never have guessed it, but it's there.
Yeah, and it's proven to be an incredibly bountiful source of value for our company. I don't know if you've talked to any of our investors, but I'm pretty aggressive in asking for things. I probably send an ask once a week to each of our investors of like something that we need as a company, somebody we need to be connected to. And it's been a huge source of value for us.
Well, you know, I'll pause you right there and kind of we'll transition to some picking a part of this, but you've already said two things that I'm like very, very fond of encouraging founders around. And the second one is not being shy about asking for help. I think there are a couple problems that I see with founders a lot. One of them has to do with maybe a little bit of that, you know, imposter syndrome or a little bit of that hero's journey. Like, I am the founder CEO. I have to fix every problem. And I'm like, no, like, you've helped people all the way till where you are today. It's now your time to start asking for help because this is a really difficult journey. And if you don't ask for help, it's going to be very tough. So I'm glad that you're able to put that out there and how much you ask for help. I think, funny enough too, I think investors want to see their founders be the squeaky wheel, right? Because they want their best companies to do well, but they won't think about the help that they can give unless it's asked of them. So kudos to you for that.
Yeah, I would add to that, knowing how to ask well is actually something that takes a lot of practice. Our asks are very specific. I've done a lot of A-B testing on this. I used to have our asks within our monthly investor update. And I did some testing where I removed the asks from the investor update. And then the next day after the update, I would just send a personal message to each of our investors that I would actually type up myself And the conversion rate went from like 1% to about 80% on the asks just by reaching out personally. And also because when you reach out personally, we might have 8 things that we need, but I know, for example, like Dick Costolo is not going to convert on like 7 of these, but he can totally do this one. So I'll just send him an email with that one thing. And like a specific thing would be, I'm looking to talk to people who understand data systems with healthcare. Can you tell me the name of one person you know who knows a lot about data systems? Like being that specific, or I'm looking to connect with other health tech founders just because I'd like to know more people in the ecosystem. Who are the 2 best health tech founders you know? If you give the investor enough of a lead where they can spend 10 seconds converting on your request, you're much more likely to get those conversions. So that's learning how to ask those questions, I think, is also an important skill.
So many like helpful tidbits around this. I could riff forever on these things with you.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. So I wanted to go back to that other thing, which is a thing that I love sharing, but you've broken down essentially the science behind it. I've always talked about this idea, and it's not for everyone, but I call it an angel army strategy. And it's when you're going out to raise, you think about, look, I know I want to raise, call it X million dollars. Let's call it $2 million. But the raising of that $2 million will probably go much faster if I can essentially pull together an angel army, right? So it can be a small amount. It can be $100,000 where, you know, the capital that you're raising is less about the dollars for operations and more about bringing what you called, I've already forgotten the term, people with high degree of network. So you talked a little bit about knowing that when you did raise money, that you knew you wanted to bring on a bunch of people like that onto your cap table first. So as you're thinking about executing that step of the process, tell me a little bit about how much you had when you were going to talk to these people.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that we indexed on most heavily was, do they care about what we're doing? And I think that's something that is often underestimated. Like we've turned down capital from some very brand name people because like they wanted to put in capital, but they weren't excited about what we're doing. And I'm a believer that the world is bountiful, and you can find people who are equally notable, but who are also interested, who actually care about what you're doing. And so that was the first thing, was just like, do they care? And oftentimes the answer was no. And if the answer is no, it's just like a polite pass. The second would be, how willing are they to be active? And like we set the expectation pretty early on, and many people opted out, just saying like, look, I love what you guys are doing, but I'm going to be honest, I don't even have 1 hour per month that I can answer these questions. Like I would send them one of our most recent investor asks. And if they say like, that's too much for me, it's like totally cool. Like really not a problem. It's totally okay. The next thing would be, we would think through network access in terms of just disparate networks, meaning networks of people that don't overlap. So like there's the tech VC world is like one dense network. Entertainment is a network. Robotics is a network. Like you can think, there's so many of these networks. So like fabric manufacturers is a network. You can think of like a nearly infinite number of these. And like, do they give us access to a new network that we otherwise would not have access to? And what's interesting is that it's often hard to predict in advance how useful disparate network access will be. Hypothetically, you have somebody in the fabric industry in your network who does apparel, and you're like, well, you know, we're in health tech. Why on earth would we need that person? And then 6 months later, you're like, man, we really need some expertise on something related to fabric. And we're like, oh, wait, we have a guy who knows everything there is to know about this already. You can just get that information. And it's really hard to know.
Have you ever heard the saying, it's not what you know, it's who you know? Sam would agree with that. If you've ever slept on networking or thought it was a dirty word, what you're about to hear is motivation to open up that email app and reconnect with people. Sam says that perspective is one of the keys to his success.
We started the company We incorporated, I think, June 26th of 2019, so a little over a year ago. We started the company by basically just raising $1 million from other friends of mine. I came to this realization maybe 5 years ago that I was doing one of these, I guess you could call it a gratitude exercise of just writing down all of the good things that have happened to me in my life and trying to think about them. And I realized that maybe 98% of those things were all because of somebody that I knew and really not because of something that I did, which is kind of a weird recognition that just being, being present and being a high integrity person that other people trust is like 98% of the battle of all of the good things that have happened to me. And so I really started emphasizing personal relationships after that. I've had the quarterly goal of staying in touch with 1,000 people that I care about for several years now. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I love that.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of time, probably 30 hours a week, but it's also the single most valuable thing that I do. Like my co-founders, Josh, I've known for 4 or 5 years, and he's somebody that I stayed in touch with. David, I've known for probably 6 or 7 years. Casey is the only person I didn't know beforehand, but she's also kind of the exception that proves the rule because her brother is somebody that I've stayed in touch with for years. And so when I was telling him about it, he was like, "You have to talk to my sister. This is what she has been talking about for years." So like even that is just through networks and maintaining contact with people that I care about. It's beyond just professional. It's also like personal happiness really comes from this as well. When it came time to raise the initial capital, it was a pretty simple process. I think the first money in was my friend Zach, who I had known for probably a year at that point, and we really connected. And he was early at Zappos. And somehow, over the course of a year of knowing him, we'd never talked about work. And I knew that he was really into health and wellness. He'd gone through his own health journey. And I was telling him about this idea that I had. And he was like, "Oh, well, that sounds really cool. Are you guys raising capital?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm thinking about it. Do you know anyone?" It's like, "You know, I'm a professional venture capitalist, right?" It's like, I did not know that, actually.
Very endearing.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I mean, that would be great. And so I basically just had some calls with friends that I knew had access to capital, who did angel investing, and or who ran funds that could connect me to other angels and founders. And we raised it very quickly. There were some people, one in particular comes to mind, who like wired us $75,000 before even signing the documents and like didn't even know what it is we were doing. But like because I'd known him for long enough, he was like, "Whatever it is you're working on, I want to fund it."
That's great. You ended up adding something like 150 angels to your cap table. Can you tell me if coming out of that angel army strategy, did you know that you were going to go straight into a bigger fundraise, or like how did you think about staging and all that?
Yeah, so we took a fairly unusual strategy. One of the things that I had experienced is in witnessing previous fundraisers and also just talking to other founder friends of mine is that price is incredibly opaque. And there's so much information asymmetry between founders and investors that I wanted to figure out a strategy for how to understand what price would be. We knew that we were going to do a larger raise at some point, but I wanted to think about what I guess you would go again to first principles, like what is price? Price is the willingness of somebody to pay for something. So it's inherently arbitrary. There's no basis of price. It's like, well, what's your EBITDA multiple? No, that's not how this operates. It is the willingness of other people to pay for it. So we thought a lot about how do you do price discovery? One of the ideas was in layering safes and just having a dilution goal for each safe increment. So we started at 10 million post just on safes. Once we filled our allocation for that, we bumped it up. And once we filled that allocation, we went to 20 million, we went to 25 million, And we would just see, we wanted to get to the point where people started saying no. And that was a sign. Like, we knew coming into our round that our valuation was going to be somewhere between 30 and 50 million, just because we knew empirically that people were willing to pay that. And any term sheet that we got that was less than that, we could fairly confidently say, I actually know with certainty that the price is more than this. So I can confidently say no to a term sheet because we know that the price is better than what we're being offered. So it was an incredibly helpful way of like building confidence in how your company should be valued. So that was the core of the strategy.
You know, it's, I'll just say this, and I can, you won't take any offense to this because you executed it flawlessly, and you raised from fantastic investors, and I think you announced the round, right? You announced a $13
million
round.
$12
million round led by Andreessen Horowitz. So it's interesting. I'd be curious if other people could execute it as well as you. You know, there is something about the perception of everything that happens within a fundraise that is incredibly important for an investor. Like they're just matching off of what they see. And what you described is your personality. That is you. So, you know, when I think about if I were, you know, running a fund and you came to pitch me and I saw this happening.
Right.
I think if another company were to try to do that to me, I would feel very like almost offended. And I was discussing this with an investor friend of mine who's looked at your rounds and seen it happen. And it's like, well, there is this irrational feeling that investors get when someone says, we just closed that round and here's a higher valuation. And you're like, well, I don't want that then. But there is something about everything that goes into who you are and like your process and your transparency and everything that goes into it that I think is very genuine. So, you know, kudos to you. That's super interesting. You know, how long did that whole thing take? How long have you been fundraising actually? Like, you're always fundraising. Like, what would your answer there be?
Kind of always fundraising, but I guess a lot less now that the round is closed. But in the early days, I think that one of the things that is often underappreciated is using investors to learn from them. I was talking to a friend who started he started an insurance company that's actually doing pretty well now, but he had been thinking about it and working on the business plan by himself for like a year before he was confident enough to pitch. And when he finally was like, all right, the deck's ready, I've got everything solved, he did his first investor pitch to a guy who knew the industry super well. And the guy was like, yeah, that's cool, but what's your distribution strategy? He's like, oh, I've got that handled. It's right here. He's like, yeah, this is completely wrong. Like, look at these four companies. They tried exactly this. There's a reason why this doesn't work. What you need to look for is this over here. And he's taking notes. He's like, man, I really should have pitched earlier because that would have saved me a lot of time because my sample size in health tech is one. And these investors have visibility into hundreds or thousands of companies. And so you might think that you're this unique snowflake. The reality is you should not be afraid to fail. I probably did, I would say easily 500 plus pitches to investors, possibly more than that. And some of those were actually me pitching, but in every case, I really did tell them like, we're gonna be raising in September. So I'd have a call in February and say, we're raising in September, but I'd love to tell you more about what we're doing. And I would have notes in advance of the call of like, I'm going to test this pitch for this investor and just see how it goes. And oftentimes it would go very poorly and that's okay. And you just like, it's like, oh, okay. So it turns out that terminology does not resonate. And then I would try a different thing. And like, you can see in my email history, I would do a pitch and like something just really clicked with the other person. And I would email the team like, whoa, guys, we really need to use more of this terminology in our language because it's totally working. Like it is the thing that gets people to understand it. So it was incredibly helpful. One of the other things is another first principles thing is that my time does not scale, but content does. And so in these conversations, investors would ask questions like, what are your unit economics? And if I would get the same question two or three times, that was an indication that everyone is going to ask this question. So I would spend a few hours writing up a long form document that I could send in advance or after the call where I'd say during the investor pitch, yeah, I can totally give you the short version of unit economics, but I'll send you a longer form document after where you can like really dig into it if you want. And so we ended up with a pretty solid data room of all of the most common questions that we got and all of the answers to those questions. So people felt confident that we were paying attention and had the answers to pretty much any question that they asked.
So it's actually a great segue into a topic I wanted to discuss with you, which is your level of transparency between you and the investor class, if you will. It's been a fun topic of conversation between me and other investors to, from an arm's length distance, observe levels. And, you know, especially an early stage company, right, where you just don't have that much data, right? Like you've been alive for a little over a year and maybe like technically operational for less than a year. So what I talk about a lot is that when you raise these rounds of capital, you are telling a story, right? There is a narrative that you are trying to get investors to believe in you. And data is so black and white. Words are so black and white when they are put on a piece of paper and let to be read without a talk track, without you representing exactly what's going on. And it's been interesting. I've even seen tweets where people have publicly lauded you without naming names about like throughout the process of raising money, opening up a data room for anyone to see. Before I like give you point and counterpoint or other ideas around that, I wanted to hear kind of what your driving force was behind it. You already mentioned that content scales and your time doesn't. Is that the primary thing that you were just like, that's what I want to do and that's what we're going to do? Or is there more to speak to?
There's definitely more. One of the things that we really index on were people who do the homework. Mm. And one of the reasons why we really liked Jeff Jordan at Andreessen, Jeff and Vijay ended up leading a round, is there were a couple of our documents where I saw in the edit history that Jeff actually corrected typos like in the meat of a 100-page document.
Amazing.
Like he actually read it and was paying attention and understood what we were doing. I think part of it is just being able to show other people what you're doing is really important and building that confidence. I think the other is that I think it is much harder to get people to care about what you're doing than it is to keep information secret. Execution is hard and ideas are easy. So people have seen our data room and they're like, oh man, like your customer personas document is public. It's like, yeah, sure. It's like, oh man, your growth strategy is public. It's like, guys, it's not a secret that you can use influencers to grow. These things are not secret. It's really just conveying that you're thinking about this in a really principled way. So very little of strategy is really that secret. Part of it is we just have sufficient confidence in our own ability to execute. If other people see our idea, it's like, yeah, okay, good luck. Like, have fun trying to do that. It's hard. Mm-hmm. So I send a list of all of our competitors when people ask. I send a list of whatever. Like, I am sufficiently confident that we can execute. We don't think about competition. We think about how do we execute at the best possible level. So I think that's the other thing. Is like, it really does build, it builds trust and confidence in other people as well. And they want to help you when you do that.
Hmm. That's fascinating to hear all those things. I mean, there are a few things that I wanted to pull out of there. The last thing you talked about in terms of not caring about competition, I talk about this a lot, mostly because in previous companies that I had been in leadership of, I was so concerned with competition.
Yeah.
And now reflecting on that, I see it in other companies, I think it's a sign of not really knowing why you specifically exist. Like, you have a very specific point of view and why you're better. And yes, there are other people that are targeting something similar, but the chances of them being exactly the same is like literally slim to none. So I really want founders to know why they shouldn't care about competition. I love hearing that. And then, you know, the other thing to bring out about all of this is that anytime I give someone advice or like sit down to talk them through things, I go, look, in this game, in early stage startups and venture capital and fundraising, on almost every specific topic worth giving advice around,
Yeah.
You can probably find two equally credible people that will give you 180-degree opposite advice.
Of course.
And the reason behind that, honestly, is you know, the devil's in the details, right? Context matters and why you do these things. And so you described a process which is exactly opposite from an investor I respect, Mark Suster, who has a whole post on never sending data rooms. Sending data rooms. And, you know, I would say that he and you probably actually see eye to eye on most things. It's just the reason he says those things. So I'm glad you were able to unpack that. Very, very, very fascinating.
And I would also say that I think the best investors also know that most of the time they're wrong. Mm-hmm. And most of the time I'm wrong. So like they'll say, I think you should do it this way. But like, that's probably not right. And what you're doing right now is also probably not right. So figure it out.
Are you a guy that'll figure it out? That's what we're betting on, right?
Exactly.
Anyone who's tried to raise money knows what it's like to be rejected. For most of us, it feels like an insult to your child and a punch to the stomach all at once. But Sam is, and I'm going to sound like a broken record here, Sam is different.
Honestly, it sounds like from my vantage point that you've executed a flawless process, but I also know that everything you see on the outside is not everything that went into it. Do you have any horror stories? Do you have any cringeworthy moments? Anything as you were going to the fundraiser, you're like, that sucked. Anything like that?
Not this time around. I've experienced it enough times and I was sufficiently methodical this time around that we didn't have any horror stories. I would say in past experience, there have definitely been problems. Like at Sightline, we raised money after I actually left the company, but I was involved in the process. The biggest mistake that we made there was we timed our funding round around when we would run out of money. And like, that's totally logical. It's like, well, we have cash for 6 months. So like in a few months, we'll start raising money and then we won't run out. The reality is you give up all of your leverage and you put yourself in a really, really bad position. And when we ended up accepting terms that were not what we were hoping for, and what you learn after that, having been through it, it's like you should raise money when you have momentum. That is the best time to raise money. When you have lots of cash, it's actually very easy to raise money. And so every founder I know who has raised a lot of capital, they always say, I wish I raised less capital and took less dilution. And everybody who ran out of money says, man, I really wish we raised more capital. So nobody's ever happy with their decision, but one of those is an existential failure. And one of those is like a slightly less awesome outcome, but still pretty awesome outcome.
Yeah.
So that was definitely one big lesson.
Well, you know, two reactions to that. And the last thing is people try to get too cute with things. They're like, well, yeah, but if we wait 3 more months, our numbers are going to be 20% higher. And then,
that's,
you know,
right,
it actually doesn't affect the valuation that much, you know,
right,
3 months.
Right.
But it does affect your ability to negotiate for sure. And then the other thing that is, it's really amazing to hear, and it's a reflection on your maturation as a founder and a fundraiser, where I asked you, like, did you have any horror stories? And it's, you know, it's actually, I bet you a lot of those bad meetings would be perceived as horror stories by other founders. But, you know, going into the process, knowing it's not going to be for everyone and not everyone's going to say yes, and people are not going to like this. But every time we do run into a negative, it'll be a learning process. It is just a great way of reframing things and a mindset that I think founders need when they're going to fundraise, at least successfully. So to flip that question, who's the most interesting person you've met or had invest in this process? And, you know, this isn't a question that I would ask most founders, but most founders don't have 150 people on their cap table.
Sure.
So, you know, there are some that you probably can't share, but any that like make you light up, personal heroes of yours, anything like that would be cool to hear.
Yeah, I'm happy to share all of it.
of course.
I have been surprised at just how incredibly active our angels have been. A friend a couple days ago asked me to put together a list of who have you been your most active angel investors. And I went through the list and it's like, I think we have 130, 140, something like that. And I was only able to pare it down to like 110
they're most all equally active. Amazing.
Yeah. It's like, these are our most active, which is, was not much of a filter. I would say, the people who have recently been most helpful, Lenny Rashitsky has been super helpful. Mm-hmm. Julie Lipton has been super helpful. Matthew Dellavedova from the Cleveland Cavaliers has been really disproportionately helpful. He's been able to make some of the most important connections to us that we would not have guessed that he had connections to.
Well, I think you just helped him get a bunch more amazing deal flow.
Oh, good. Yeah. I mean, I could just list names for days. Yeah. We have almost every person we have involved has been just incredibly helpful.
That's very cool. And then, you know, a question I like asking every founder, you know, do you remember when Jeff Jordan called you and said he wanted to lead the round?
Yeah, I called him. He signed up on our wait list, and I was receiving emails for every person who signed up on our wait list. And I saw that he had signed up and wanted to be in the beta program. So I did a lot of user research myself. I think I interviewed personally maybe 600 people by phone from the waitlist, just to deeply understand who your customers are,
right,
and what do they want, and like, what does success look like for them? What is the job to be done? Where do they get their information from? Mm-hmm. How do we basically using that user research to build what our marketing strategy would be? And Jeff was one of those people. He signed up for the waitlist. We got him on the program, and I told him that, you know, we weren't looking to raise yet. I think that was in June or July when I talked to him. And he ended up coming on as an angel investor because he's personally really interested in this. His daughter's a diabetic. His wife is involved in almost every major diabetes nonprofit. He really, really cares about personal health. And so it just seemed like a great fit as an angel investor. And he was incredibly active in like a very disproportionate way. He was super helpful with all of our asks. I could tell that he really cared about what we were doing. And that was a huge factor. Coming into our fundraise, Andreessen was our top choice, specifically because of our interactions with Jeff. I sent a survey out to 50 other founder friends of mine when we were in the late stages of how do you decide what firm you want to go with? And the thing that was most interesting to me, almost every founder who has in like a late stage company, they say that the most important thing is the partner that you're working with, hands down. Mm-hmm. The firm is nice, but you have to really like the partner. You're basically married to this person. And so we just felt really good with just like the personal interest in what it is we were doing and the reputation that he had. Every person I know who has worked with Jeff say he is the best and he's an excellent person to work with. So yeah, after doing a lot of this user research, he was one of those calls. And at a certain point, I think this was in August, we put the stake in the ground of like, all right, we are running our process on this week in September. So anything you want to do beforehand, if you're new to the partner meetings now or later, we are looking for term sheets that week. So if you just say like, I want to get all the term sheets this week in September, 2.5 months from now, it gives everyone enough time to like really do their diligence and understand what decision they're making.
Yeah. Well, look, very atypical answer for a very atypical process, but like we've mentioned a couple times in this conversation, executed very well. I think the thing that is very universally applicable, I'm trying to pull out things that are worth and actually able to be executed by other people, is that I think the dynamic between you and Jeff Jordan, which made it such a great process, is that you really built a relationship, right? And and you know, early on, I think the investors want to invest in known quantities, founders that they believe in, understanding the way they think about people. And so I would say, especially how the market has been, there's been so much investing that is done like very rapid fire. But I think you do see the best outcomes and the best sort of investors matching up with great founders when there has been an ability for them to meet ahead of time, to like meet them outside of the normal fundraising environment, having an early conversation at least. Obviously, you took that to another level, and this another level, at levels.
Talking avoid puns.
Yeah, I was waiting to drop that. And then the last, you know, look, the last phase of conversation that I like talking about is just, are there a couple things that you've been very happy with or lessons that you've learned that you would tell a younger version of Sam, or maybe that you like sharing with other founders as they think about particularly fundraising processes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest ones, and we can reference Mark Suster again. He wrote a famous post on investing in lines rather than dots. Hmm. I would highly recommend writing a monthly investor update and keeping yourself accountable to it. We send our investor update every month on the 15th. Mm-hmm. And it has both the good and the bad and like challenges that you're facing. And you just be honest. Everyone knows that companies run into problems, and that's okay. If you have a challenge, you can talk about it. And if people see over time that you overcome these challenges and that you can execute, that is a really good way of building trust. And so when there are people that say you want them to potentially lead your funding round in several months or a year, them being able to see a year of steady progress is incredibly valuable. Like, they know that you're not a fly-by-night organization. They understand how you execute. Building that trust is incredibly important. So we send it on the 15th because we get our books every month on the 10th. That's when we get our financials. And so by the 15th, we're able to ship it. I probably spend 4 hours a month writing it. Everyone on our team writes basically what their department does, and we compile it, we write it, send it out. Add people that you think you might want to be involved in a future process, just add them to it. Keep them on the distribution list so they know what you're up to. I would say that building that trust even very early on. I think we started shipping our investor update when we had like 5 people at the company. So, and we had very few investors, but the goal was to have that discipline to distribute that information and keep that mentality of like constantly showing people how you're executing over time.
Everyone that I know that is involved in Levels from an investor point of view raves about the team and your in particular ability to execute. So not shocked at, you know, shocked at some of the answers, honestly, in this conversation, but at a certain level, not shocked. I think I was expecting something like this.
That was my interview with Sam Korkos, founder and CEO of Levels. But don't leave just yet, because we found someone to give us another perspective.
Hey, hopefully this lighting works.
After this message, an early investor joins our debrief to tell us how she knew betting on Sam would pay off. Early on at my last company, we had the chance to sell into a large public company, but ran into a wall. They wouldn't work with us unless we were SOC 2 certified. We really tried for weeks to get something done. We were Googling how to get SOC 2 certified and interviewing expensive consultants. But in the end, we abandoned the deal because it was too distracting. So when I learned about Vanta, a company that was just backed by Sequoia, used by hundreds of SaaS startups to get SOC 2 certified, I was so annoyed. I mean, I really wish they had been around back then. Vanta makes it super easy to get a variety of certifications like ISO 27001, SOC 2, the certification we needed to get, and HIPAA. They integrate with your cloud provider and other tools you already use to automate the super complex and time-consuming process of preparing for an audit. Anyway, if you'd like to drop a months-long process down to weeks like I would have back then and actually sign those major contracts, you should check out Vanta. Also, I'm really happy to share that listeners of Funded get hooked up. You all can get $1,000 off your service by going to vanta.com/funded. That's vanta.com/funded. Okay, back to the show.
Remember Sam's shout out to an investor named Julia Lipton? Julia, this is Olivia. Olivia,
hi.
My good friend.
Hi.
Julia.
Hey, Olivia.
We got Julia to hop on a call with me and my producer, Olivia. Olivia, this is cool. We don't usually get a chance to speak twice about one interview. And for listeners, the reason we're doing this is because we pulled some strings and we were able to get Julia Lipton, founder of Awesome People Ventures and one of the investors that Sam Korkos name drops in the episode. So Welcome to our debrief, Julia.
Thanks, Jason.
Yeah, welcome.
Thanks, Olivia. Happy to be here.
You know, usually when we do this, we have a debrief and Olivia just kind of reacts to what she heard. And when we talk about it from a different point of view and I try to break it down in easier terms,
awesome.
What I kind of want to do this time is I've been waiting to talk to another investor so that I can get all these questions out of like, is this really crazy just to me or was it crazy to other people? So I have all these questions to ask you, Julia, and then Olivia, I'm sure some of this stuff is going to inspire some other things. So please chime in wherever.
Okay.
But Julia, so you didn't get a chance to hear the whole episode, but Sam breaks down a fairly unique process. And one of those things that he talks about is just the way he ran essentially a pricing discovery exercise with a ton of stack notes. And I want to know, where did you fit into this equation? Like, when did you meet him and where along in the process?
Yeah. So I met him in September of 2019.
Oh, no way. Early.
And so I met him pretty early on through a mutual friend. And my friend wanted me to take a look at it because he knew that I had led growth and revenue at Rise, which was a nutrition coaching startup. So he thought that I might be interested in Levels. So I met him quite early on, but it took me 6-7 months until I invested.
No way. And now I'm realizing that I've already used a bunch of insider language, inside baseball language. So when I said stack notes for everyone.
Yeah. What was that?
Yeah. I was like, oh yeah, Olivia totally picked up all of this from
four episodes. No.
Yeah. Okay. Stack notes. So a note is the vehicle that many early stage companies raise money on. So the investment vehicle, the thing that people use to take in money.
Wait, I'm so sorry. I'm not even sure I understand that concept. What's a vehicle in this context?
Yeah, so it's essentially the legal entity that an investor will put money into in order to gain that upside in the company, right? And shorthand for it, they'll call it a note.
Okay, okay.
One version of it is called a note. And generally speaking, the reason I threw out this term, stacked notes, is that it's unique. I mean, it's not a lot of people do this. When they raise money, it's usually one note and they take in that note and they take the money that they need to get to the next milestone and then they go raise again. Sam did something a little bit different when I think Julia had a front row seat because she met him actually at the very beginning. And so when we talk about stacking notes, it means he raised one note and then immediately after raised another note on different terms. And so that's what he was talking about in terms of stacking notes and increasing valuation. So I didn't know that about when Julia, you met Sam, which means I get to ask, when did you first consider and where along the ride did you actually get on board?
So I don't remember, to be honest, what the valuation was when I met him. I think it was an 8. And when I first met him, I'll never forget because our first meeting was a phone call. And most founders, their first meeting is a Zoom. And he was pretty adamant about a phone call. And now I understand that's because Sam walks 10 miles a day while taking all of these phone calls. But at the time, I didn't know it. And I was like, okay, you want to take a phone call? I'm going to go for a hike in Sausalito. So I remember this call so viscerally. And at the time, they were basically just distributing Abbott devices to people through their doctor prescription network. And I was like, you guys haven't done anything. You've built a doctor prescription network. That isn't a product, that isn't a brand, that isn't anything. But what was so interesting about Sam is whenever he says he's going to do something, he does it. And then he follows up with you to tell you that he's done it. And so I had all these questions and concerns, and we had this ongoing back and forth that quite literally lasted 6 months and a few meetings in between.
Sure, sure.
And dozens of emails. So I met him, I think it was at an 8. I did it at a 10. Then I was going to do another SPV at an 18 because I just really believe and I still believe. And I missed that 18 window, but we got in at the 25, which was before A16Z led their most recent round.
So a lot of things that she just threw out, I'm seeing Olivia's face and she doesn't even have to chime in. Like I know this is a good moment. So first of all, Julia invested first at an 8 and then wanted to raise another SPV, right?
Yeah.
10. You missed the 8, of course.
I missed the 8.
Everyone I've talked to missed something with Sam and then finally got on. Raised at 10 and then wanted to raise an SPV, a special purpose vehicle. So raising money for the sole purpose of investing in this opportunity, and then wanted to do even more. And so before I even go on, like, Julia, you kind of talked about that, like, oh yeah, not a big deal. Personally, I've never seen that happen. And I've seen a lot of deals. I've never seen somebody come and continue to raise a valuation on investors and continually successfully do it.
Yeah.
Julia, can you talk a little bit about that? Was that normal to you? Have you seen that before?
So it wasn't normal to me. I'd never seen this before. But the thing that I've come to understand about Sam is nothing that he does is normal. And over time, I've now known him for over a year. I've just come to trust him. And the best founders do things their own way. So when he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. So while to me, the stacking notes feels very risky, and I remember asking him about it, being like, hey, Sam, like, what's the plan here? This dilution, like, it's going to get kind of messy. And he shared me a doc where they had it all mapped out and assured me that it was going to be okay. And in fact, he pulled it off.
I'm wondering if you can explain, why is it risky?
Julia, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, what happens is founders will end up taking on too much money and taking on too much dilution such that when they go out to raise their next round, there isn't enough space for the funds to come in and or the founders end up over diluting themselves. And so they can't bring on the investors that they want to bring on because those investors don't have enough space to be able to write the check size they need to write to be able to get into the round. Oh. And or founders can't raise at the valuation they need to be able to keep a reasonable dilution target.
Wait, so, okay, tell me if I'm understanding this correctly. So basically, the problem is not in the first round, it's in the second.
Your first institutional round. Jason, feel free to jump in.
Yes, so Olivia, you have that right. So essentially, if I had to like break it down in different words, is you start setting expectations for another round, the next round that you raise, that if you don't meet them, it can create a situation that actually makes it hard for institutions to get excited enough to put enough money behind it and actually back you at that stage.
Mm. Okay, so it sounds like you need a lot of confidence that you'll be able to meet your thresholds or whatever.
Yes.
And Olivia, I'm so glad you used that word because this is 100% the theme for breaking down Sam and Sam's process and Sam's unique strategy, which I think we talk about in the conversation and we've talked about in our debriefs, and he executed it flawlessly. And it's honestly amazing to watch. But I would say that if anyone's trying to draw from this, the analogy that I give is that if we did a conversation about golf with Tiger Woods, and Tiger Woods was like, you know, this is how I would improve my shot making and how I would, you know, shoot a 62 the next time I went out. On these types of holes, I would carve the ball just ever so slightly and land it, you know, 2 feet below the hole so that I could make the putt. And if amateurs were listening to this, it would be like, oh, so should I go do that the next time I play golf? Should I be trying to, like, you know, shape the ball and hit it perfectly there? So ideally, yeah, that's what you do, but it requires so much confidence and so much skill in order to do what Sam did that I couldn't really recommend just everyone doing this. Julia, are you on the same page here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing I was going to say is when it's a little bit related to this, Olivia, is like you asked, what are the risks? Julia definitely talked about one. One for me is that I think the first time I heard what was happening without even meeting Sam, I was really turned off about even just like hearing what was happening. And it felt like someone was being a little bit too cute and trying something tricky. And like, in that case, like, I'm not interested. I don't need to be gamed around any of this stuff. And so like, if you're not doing this for the reasons and with the confidence that Sam did in executing this, the risk is that you go try to run this process and you're like, yep, this note's closed, here's the next note at a higher valuation. Oh, sorry, you missed that one. Here's another one at a higher valuation. Is that people, if they don't believe that you are as execution focused and as incredible of an operator as Sam is, you might get everyone to turn away. So that was one of the big risks that I came away with.
Yeah.
Similar, Julia?
Yeah, I think that's very real. But the other piece of this component is for every investor along the way, there's these notes that are getting higher and higher and more expensive and more expensive. And they're closing and they're closing and they're closing. And as an investor, it's like, you got to get on the train, you miss the train, you got to get on the train, you miss it. And in parallel to watching the price go up, you're also seeing the company updates. So you're watching them hit milestone, hit milestone, hit milestone, and you're building more and more conviction. And he's excellent with email follow-ups and sending docs. He has this process so dialed. I'm not sure if he shared, but he is one of the top users of Superhuman because he is a machine. And so as an investor, you have these two things happening in parallel. You're seeing the price go up, what feels like in real time, which doesn't usually happen in private companies, and you're building more and more conviction and gaining more and more company insights. And this only works is if you know that every time there's a touch point, every week, every month, you're going to be nailing it and nailing it and nailing it. And if you are that good, you can do creative things, but very, very, very few companies can execute this.
So I wanted to ask you, now that I know Julia, when you joined, I think he probably raised 3 or 4 more notes after you, and then the full equity round from Andreessen Horowitz. Tell me a little bit about what you observed or what you saw, maybe what you heard directly from Sam as he was going in to formally raise the, I guess, $10 to $12 million round that ended up being led by Andreessen Horowitz. Was he telling investors that this was happening? Or were you just kind of watching with popcorn?
Yep. He was like, I am going to close the round at this date. Like, we are going to go out on this date and we're going to close the round at this date.
Okay. So you're laughing a little bit and shaking your head and just narrating what I'm seeing here. Tell me a little bit more about why that was crazy. From what your experience, having done many, many rounds of investment and seen it happen, what was so crazy about that?
Well, one, the time frame that he was planning for was very short. So it can take founders 3, 6, 9 months to raise. The current market is a little bit different, but traditionally it can take founders quite some time to raise. So one, I was like, okay, let's see. And then two, how specific he was on when he was going to do what and why. And again, it just comes down to this plan. Like, he knows that he's milestone, milestone, milestone. And because they're so consistent, they can plan very effectively.
That's amazing. Well, look, here's my question. We've said that a lot of what was covered in the interview with Sam is kind of like showing what Tiger Woods would do and then maybe creating the false perception that a new golfer should do that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about things that you saw Sam do that you're like, I want more founders to do this. Something that is a little bit more accessible, if you will.
Yeah. So one, he's incredible at sharing company updates. In every investor update, he says, our goal is still not growth. Our goal is product, technology, and execution. Mm-hmm. He's committing to delivering on the things he knows he can win at. Now, it just happens that the growth for that company is out of control, but he set himself up to be able to deliver month after month after month.
Great. Julia, last thing I just popped in my mind. What is the most unique thing about Sam that you've seen, not fundraising or startup related?
He doesn't use to-do lists.
No way.
So everything is on his calendar. And his calendar drives his life, which means he has almost no mental energy spent on worrying about things to do. Because if there's something he needs to do, he just puts a block on his calendar. And at that point, he assumes it's going to get done because he's so disciplined about following his calendar. And so what's interesting to me is most people have this gap between like thinking, anxiety, wondering, and then doing. He doesn't have that. He just like has a thought. And he puts time on the calendar to deal with it.
That's cool. I'm glad you shared that.
It's pretty admirable. I've been working on the same strategy myself, not executing quite as well, but one can dream.
Yeah, I can only imagine what your calendar looks like. Not a lot of room for these little tasks, so.
Oh my gosh.
Anyways, Julia, thanks for finding some time for this. This is going to be an amazing counterpoint for people to hear from, and illuminating given how interesting the conversation with Sam was. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
So that was our debrief with special guest Julia Lipton of Awesome People Ventures. By the way, much love to Julia, who held off a bona fide investing legend to give our audience the scoop on Sam.
Oh, shit. Oh, fuck. I forgot that Mike Maples rescheduled our meeting to now.
For those who don't know who Mike Maples is, he's the founder of the VC firm Floodgate and first investor in a few tiny companies you might have heard of, like Twitter, Lyft, and Twitch. So yeah, oh, fuck is right. Hi, it's Jason from The Present here, talking to you from the tail end of 2021. We originally aired the Sam Korkos Levels episodes at the start of the year, when it seemed like this was the year we were really going to stick to our New Year's resolutions. Cue actual tape from Olivia after she first heard my conversation with Sam.
Yeah, no, you brought up 2020. I'm going to bring up 2021. I think he gave us so many New Year's goals or resolutions, whatever you want to call it. Like, I am going to channel my inner Sam during 2021 and reach out to people that I've been meaning to, check in with people, because I totally believe in what he's saying, that it, you know, it will pay off. And it also just would be nice in this time of the pandemic to, I should invest in those connections, you know, just to feel more connected.
Well, with 2022 just a few months away, it's time to check in on our progress with my producer, Olivia, in a segment we're calling The Debrief to the Debrief. For this special episode, Olivia and I both recorded 60-second reactions to how that conversation with Sam sits with us now 279 days later. I'm up first. Okay, I'm setting up for this 60-second debrief of a debrief. This is going to be tough for me. I'm actually kind of a slow talker, so jamming everything into 60 seconds I feel like is going to be really tough. And also, there's so much to talk about with Sam Korkos, so here we go. I have a stopwatch set up. I'll put 60 seconds on the clock and begin now. Okay, so the first thing I'll say is that since the Sam Korkos episode aired, so many people have reached out wanting to learn more, wanting to see if they could recreate what Sam did. And honestly, I've seen it quite a bit. It's almost become commonplace, and maybe it's because of us, who knows? The other weird thing is, or wild thing, is that while when we thought Sam was doing some crazy things, both stacking notes and getting to crazy valuations, valuations have become even crazier. Out of YC this last batch, we were seeing companies with very little raise at $40 million valuations. What else? Sam was what we thought the most transparent person in the world in what he was sharing in the podcast. But since then, his company has become even more transparent, sharing what they do, even in a podcast that really walks through the details of their culture and how they get things done. I thought that was amazing. New Year's resolutions. Honestly, I haven't done well. I haven't been reaching out to friends and family, but I really want to. I have 3 seconds left, and just saying, in the last two months, I'm going to try to reach out to more people. Okay, I think I got it all in. I know Sam Korkos can probably run a mile in 60 seconds or pull off some other hyper-efficient feat, but for us normals, not a lot of time. Okay, Olivia, you're up next. Clock's ticking.
3, 2, 1, go. Okay, my thoughts on the Sam Korkos episode were, well, I know this exercise is about checking between, wow, I sound like a politician. There's so much filler in this already. Oh my gosh, I wasted 10 seconds. Okay, so my thoughts are that I have not done a good job on maintaining relationships through email, following up with people like I freaking said on the record that I would. And one thing that does really inspire me is that he's doing this for 30 hours a week. And so it's not transactional. Like he doesn't have 30 hours a week worth of asks to go out. He's literally just checking in on people. And to me, that's what I needed to take from this. The eigenvector, I think that that is a really fancy way to describe something that, don't mean to brag, but is pretty instinctual to me. Wow, that sounded so braggy. Oh, I'm over. Shoot. Okay, thank you. Goodbye. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk, as the kids say. Bye.
Thanks for listening to our special broadcast. FYI, if you're wondering why our airing schedule has been off, it's because we've been dying to air a super insightful conversation with a founder that investors are flocking to. But their fundraising announcement keeps getting delayed, and therefore, so does our episode. The good news is, regardless of what happens, we'll be in your feed next Tuesday with a brand new episode of Funded.